Good morning, everybody. This is Jane Cormier, your host for Artful Living here on WKXL, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com. That's WKXL, 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, and 101.9 FM in Manchester. Welcome to our show today. We love to have our listeners join us on Artful Living here at WKXL. And today is going to be one of those fun shows for moi, because I get to talk with a very great friend and a fellow lover of the opera medium. So we're going to welcome today Wayne Rivera. Hello, Wayne.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a lovely day here in Connecticut. The sun is actually out.
There you go. It's spring is coming. I mean, we just got to hang on for a little bit now.
Yep.
We're over the hump. All righty. For our listeners out there, you probably know that we're going to be offering New Hampshire Opera Idol, which is a emerging singer competition for young opera singers. And they come in and send in their resumes, and our judges, Wayne Rivera is one. And of course, you guys remember that we talked to Josh Collier last week. He's another judge. These two wonderful human beings are going to pick our preliminary contestants for the final round that will happen on April 28th, right at the... Go ahead.
It's a hard one this year, Jane.
Oh, is it?
It's a hard one. We've got a lot of very good people.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, yeah. You know what? It's going to be a fun afternoon. We've really changed for one time, we're going to see how it goes. We've changed the format somewhat. And we're going to be at the Bank of New Hampshire. They have a beautiful room. It's like a club room, a club atmosphere in the Canton Room. And there's a beautiful Steinway piano. And we're going to have a laid-back finals round for New Hampshire Opera Idol in this area, in this space. And, of course, you know, it's not as big as a theater would be. I mean, I think you're going to top out probably at like 80, 90 people. But it's going to be different. You know, we can maybe make it a little bit more personal for people that are coming out to see the finals and have a different marketing idea, that we don't have to be so highbrow, that opera is really just a regular thing that everybody can enjoy. So that's going to be the thought. We'll see how it goes. And, I do want to talk a little bit about Wayne Rivera today, because, you know, even though we sang together a long time ago, yeah, I don't really know a whole lot about how you started. And you've been on our program 3 or 4 times. It might be interested to talk a little bit. Let's find out, Wayne Rivera, the opera singer, how did you get your start?
Well, I started because I started in high school, actually. I was a very early opera lover.
Wow.
I had a grandfather who absolutely loved opera, an Italian grandfather. Everybody thinks my Rivera is Spanish. It's actually the Italian version of Rivera.
Uh-huh.
And for people who are sports fans, Johnny Rivera, spelled with the Italian G-I-A-N-N-I,
uh-huh,
is actually a pretty famous soccer player in Italy. So this is an Italian Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, and as a little boy, I used to listen to the opera with my grandfather. So I got a really good flavoring,
wow,
and a very good taste for that early on. And then I discovered that I actually had a voice and I loved to sing. So I sang a lot in high school and decided to go to Indiana University way back when it just first began, because that was the opera school at the time.
It certainly was. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Was it hard to get in there?
At that time, it was difficult.
I would think
they had a lot of people wanting to go. It's really, some people have called it an opera factory. They do an opera every Saturday night at Indiana. Not a different opera, but they do it. They run it in repertoire.
Sure.
So for people that like opera, it was a really terrific school to go to.
Absolutely. For those that don't know, Indiana University was like the place, one of the two or three, I think, best places in the world that you could go to study the art form,
yeah,
of becoming a singer, a performer on stage.
Yeah. They also had wonderful facilities. They had wonderful theaters and, I guess, quite a bit of money dedicated to the opera program. And so they were able to really present a terrific program for people, singers, conductors, instrumentalists,
sure,
everything. So I went there as a freshman, and I, in retrospect, that might have been a little early. I was only 17.
Holy moly.
And I did go on a scholarship. And of course, I was 17, and I wanted to sing Aida at that point, which which would not have been a good idea.
Yeah, a little big, just a little big.
A little big, yeah. But I went there, and actually, I had a thing with my father because he said that, you know, people getting a vocal performance degree didn't have a job at the end of the road. So we compromised, and I got a double degree in vocal performance and music education.
Wow.
And so I was there for 5 years and three summers, and went immediately on to the Santa Fe Opera as an apprentice. I auditioned for them and got in as an apprentice.
That was quick.
It was very quick. And then from there, I met, of course, a lot of people at the Santa Fe Opera, which was another incredibly wonderful opera place.
Sure.
It was when it first began in New Mexico. And I was actually the apprentice there the year the Opera House burned down.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
And, yes, it burned to the ground at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
they built a new one for the next year. So I was there the year it burned down, and I was there the year that the new one opened.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, for folks that are listening, I hope that you're I want you to make sure that you understand. I mean, not only is Indiana University in those days like the A place, Santa Fe was as well. It was tough to get in there, very competitive and world renowned with regard to, you know, assisting those singers onto big careers. These weren't small places to start out. And the fact that you did it all very quickly just, you know, really goes to show what was happening there.
Well, I think as in any field, once you get into the field and you start networking with people, things can start to happen pretty quickly. So, of course, I was networking with the apprentices as well as a lot of the artists. And then I decided that I would go for a master's at New England Conservatory in Boston.
Wow. Okay.
Which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wound up staying in Boston. Boston's quite a musical city.
Yeah.
I stayed in Boston for 12 years, and then I had a friend that went on to Germany, and she said, listen, we need tenors in Germany. So over to Germany I went, and then next thing I knew, I met Jane Cormier.
Oh, yeah. I think there was a lot more going on in your world than you're saying. But you know what? So you were 12 years in Boston, and Boston's not really an opera town, though. It's like early music. Were you doing early music, a lot of early music?
I did. I had the kind of voice that I was able to do a lot of early music, which was good because that was sometimes how I paid the rent, was the early music stuff.
Of course.
And many, many Messiahs and lots of oratorio and that kind of stuff.
But, well, that's what a great education.
I was in Boston in the years of Sarah Caldwell, who was a pretty famous name in Boston back then.
Right.
One of the first women to kind of become a big
force.
Opera name.
Yes.
And they did quite a bit of opera. And she was. And they she did, the thing is that Sarah did a lot of crazy operas. She didn't always do just the bread and butter, meat and potatoes operas. She did lots of operas that people had never heard of, War and Peace and things like
sure.
that.
Yeah.
So it was interesting.
Did you like working with her, Wayne?
Yes and no.
Okay. And you know what? We hear that a lot. So for folks out there, again, you know, so some of our listeners might really not know Sarah Caldwell. So she was an extremely strong woman that came into the opera world and really somewhat turned it on its ear. She was fearless. And
she
was a great musician. I think Sarah Caldwell, I liked her musicianship as far as what she did with the pieces that you can, you know, you can understand. The other repertoire you're talking about, I'm not so well versed in. But how did you find actually working with her?
Well, she started, I believe she was a violist in the orchestra.
Really?
And,
oh,
yes,
my gosh.
I believe. And she was in Tanglewood, and she met a man called Boris Goldovsky, who was a Russian immigrant who had come to the United States and started the Goldovsky Opera Company.
And he was the man. I'm sorry. What a man.
Yeah. He was quite an incredible man and a real fount of knowledge.
Yes.
He had a tremendous background and tremendous knowledge, and he was a very witty, funny man. He was almost like an opera comic as well as an opera aficionado as well as an opera in some ways a genius. And he had Goldovsky Opera Company, which went all over the country and toured operas. And he was at Tanglewood, and he sort of took Sarah under his wing.
Wow.
And that's how she got her initial opera training. And then she went on to have Boston Opera and Opera Boston, and she was fearless because
she was.
She wasn't too great in the financial department.
Yes.
And there were a lot of money there were a lot of money problems along the way, as there is in opera, because opera is a very expensive endeavor.
Indeed.
And but she seemed to come up, and then she gained national notoriety. I think she made the cover of Time magazine, which was a big accomplishment.
She was really important. We're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Sarah Caldwell and hopefully Boris Goldovsky. And we want everybody to stay right where they are here on WKXL, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You are with Art for Living here on WKXL, 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, and 101.9 FM in Manchester. Jane Cormier, your host today, and we're talking the world of opera today here on Art for Living. Our guest is Wayne Rivera, who is a very learned gentleman and an opera performer and an opera teacher and an opera director. And he's talking to us a little bit about his background getting into the business. He's also going to be one of the judges for New Hampshire Opera Idol, which is coming up April 28th. But, you know, having known Wayne for quite a few years, his very beginning, I really wasn't fully, I'm learning with you. You know, what Wayne Rivera was all about when he was starting out. So you were working with Goldovsky, Boris Goldovsky, and Sarah Caldwell in Boston.
Correct.
For a number of years. What operas did you do with Caldwell?
Well, I was still a student. I was a master's student, but I was still a student. So I did a couple of choruses with her to start out, and then I did a Macbeth with her, which doesn't have a big tenor part, but it has a big aria.
Mm-hmm.
I did that with her. And then she did some really crazy pieces. She did a piece called Mavra of Stravinsky, which no one seems to have heard of.
I don't think I know that one. Mavra.
No, it's Mavra. Yeah. It's a esoteric piece. It's not one of the mainstream.
Yeah.
But, interesting, interesting piece.
I'm sure.
And, she did a lot of, offbeat pieces as well as standard rep. And of course, she was able to hire really important singers at that time. She gave, you know, Beverly Sills was with her for quite a bit when she first got her start. I did a Lucia with her with Beverly Sills. I didn't sing Edgardo. I was still a student. I sang the second tenor part of Arturo, but I got to be on the stage with Beverly Sills.
Yeah, and, gosh, come on.
Yeah,
that's great. Good for you.
So,
how was she to work with on the stage?
It was difficult because Sarah would kind of do it, you know, off the top of her head.
Mm-hmm.
And very often she would change things at the last minute.
Yeah. A lot of great directors do that.
Yep. Yes. Well, she did. And she was a great director. I remember. And she would go to great lengths to ensure that she had lots of special effects visually, too. She was very visual. I remember one of the things that impressed me tremendously. I didn't sing in this one, but she did a performance of Semiramide of Rossini.
Mm-hmm.
And she had Joan Sutherland and Marilyn Horne.
Wow, both. That was with Caldwell?
That was with Sarah Caldwell.
Holy
Marilyn Horne. Marilyn Horne was 7 months pregnant. And she was playing the part of an Assyrian soldier, male soldier. It was what they call a pants role. She was dressed in pants, and she was playing a young man at 6 months pregnant. So it was visually, it was a little strange.
Oh, my.
That's
funny.
Joan Sutherland, I'll never forget this. This is one of those moments in opera where you, visual moments, where you say, boy, that was just unbelievable. Joan Sutherland has a very big aria called Bel Raggio Lusinghiere in Semiramide, which she sang magnificently. And Sarah had gone to a place called Animals for Anything, that you could hire animals, trained animals, for just about anything you needed.
Holy moly,
Sarah went to them, and she got she hired them, to, of all things, a pair of white doves. And they, yeah, and I said, well, Sarah's, and she had this, and she waited until the dress rehearsal before she did it, and she told people. She hired this animal trainer from Animals for Anything, and she got a pair of white doves that they had at the back of the theater, and they had to put some lights up for them, but they put some kind of something on Joan Sutherland's shoes.
No!
And at the end of her aria, in the postlude to the aria, they released these two white doves from the back of the audience, and they flew around, and they landed at Joan Sutherland's feet because they were attracted to whatever they put on her shoes. And it was one of those visual moments that you could hear the whole audience just kind of gasp. And those were the magic moments of Sarah. she had some magic moments. She had some not magic moments,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
And to say she was dedicated to her art would be an understatement.
Correct.
One time when I, at the beginning, she was in the Back Bay Theater before she went downtown to Boston. And I had left my theory assignment in the dressing room the night before. So I went to the Back Bay Theater to get my theory assignment at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the janitor let me in. And I told him who I was, and he said, yeah, I can go back to the dressing room. And I walked through the entire house, and it looked like there was a big pile of tarps on the aisle there. And I said, I'll have to walk around that. And I looked, as I got closer, I realized that it was actually Sarah lying in the aisle,
what?
Asleep under a great
what?
Big blanket. She had slept all night in the theater, apparently.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's the kind of stuff that she did, and we always had a good laugh over that because we said, well, Sarah is dedicated.
She was dedicated.
Certainly dedicated.
And to the right, you know, I know that there are all kinds of stories out there. The money issue was huge. Sometimes being a difficult personality was out there. But you know what? No one could ever, ever say that she was anything but 110% in all the time.
Yeah. Yep, yep. And at her best, you couldn't beat her. You really couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did go on to later, after she stage direct, she started to conduct a little bit.
Yes.
And that happened. I have all these stories that are almost unbelievable, but I was actually there. She did a performance of Tosca once, which that was early on. I was in the chorus. And Beverly Bauer was the Tosca. She was a very blonde Tosca.
Ooh.
With a blonde wig. And Tosca is notoriously... Yeah. An Italian diva with black hair.
Yes, well, how did they pull that off?
Well, it's funny because the tenor has an aria in the first very opening of the opera where he talks about Tosca, Floria Tosca, and he says, a Bruna Floria.
Yes.
And he says, you know, she's dark. And, of course, Beverly Bauer refused to wear a black wig because she was a blonde. So Sarah just changed the word and she put it. And the tenor sang, a Bionda Floria.
Yeah. Wow, that's
which
weird.
Which is very, very untraditional.
Yeah, totally.
But the funny part of that story is that the conductor, who shall go nameless, showed up drunk at the performance.
Gosh.
And had a big fight with Sarah and stormed out with the orchestra score and left the theater.
Oh, my God.
So everybody was, you know, what are we going to do? There's no conductor. So Sarah said, no problem. She put on a black dress.
What?
She took her piano vocal score, and she went down into the pit, and she conducted the orchestra from the piano vocal score. And that's how she started her conducting career. So the next thing we knew, Sarah was not only staging the opera, but she was
doing
conducting
everything.
The opera.
You know, and I heard that she was pretty reliable, that she was a decent singer-conductor. Is that true?
Yes, she wasn't bad. Yeah. No, she wasn't bad at all. She was, the singers didn't seem to complain about her conducting.
Yeah.
I don't know what the orchestra had to say.
I don't know. That's a whole other thing. But I always heard that she was a, you know, even though that wasn't what she started out with, that she was a good musician, a solid musician, mm-hmm. and that the singers never really had, you know, issues with the times that she did conduct. You know what? I can understand she probably could have done that from the pit. She was probably dealing with rubato and slowing down and tempi stuff, most of all, and
uh-huh.
probably knew the score enough to know where the big entrances were, you know, for the parts.
Yep.
So good for her. You know, yeah. Wow, good for her.
No, she was fearless, and you know, sometimes that counts for a lot.
It counts for a lot. You bet. Sometimes the men from the boys is
right.
How fearless you are. Absolutely.
Right.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah. What a great story. I love having you on because you know what? You always share such great stuff. Really wonderful stories.
As someone said to me one time, Wayne, you couldn't make this up.
You have to write a book. Write a book. You should have someone come and interview and write a book.
Oh, I had a few stories about Sarah, but
maybe you shouldn't share.
Yeah, I have a couple, but I probably shouldn't say on the air, too. But it was certainly an interest. It was never boring, I'll say that.
What an education. Yeah. And you know, Wayne, we're not able to give that education today. We really are not.
No, well, it was kind of hands-on education,
right.
Jane. You know?
Right.
And you had to experience it, not just only talk about it. And
That's a dimensional education, and that makes greatness on the stage when we have that. Another greatness, while we're talking greatness, Boris Goldovsky. I have to tell you, totally by accident, I went and did a summer at... My goodness, it was in New Jersey. I can't remember. It's not coming to my mind. They used to do summer programs at this New Jersey college. I've got to think about it during our break. I hear the music. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back, and I'll see if I can use my phone here and figure out during the break what college that was. But I have some stories on Boris Goldovsky, which I'd love to share, and I'd love to hear what you have to say because he's one of my heroes. He really is. All right, we're going to take a break here. WKXL, 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, and 101.9 FM in Manchester. Stay right where you are because we're coming right back. Welcome back. Jane Cormier here for Artful Living on WKXL, New Hampshire Talk Radio. And we have a wonderful opera program for you today. Wayne Rivera is our guest. And Wayne Rivera has just about done and seen it all on the operatic realm. And he's always a great guest. We've been sitting here talking about some wonderful characters within opera. Sarah Caldwell in Boston. And that's actually where Wayne got started after graduating Indiana University. This segment, we're going to talk a little bit about Boris Goldovsky. And when we ended the last segment, I was saying, you know, I couldn't remember the name of that college. It was probably in 1985, maybe four even. But I got to spend 2 weeks at a program. Is it Westminster? I think it was Westminster. Does that sound right?
New Jersey, yeah, yes. That could be.
Yeah, Westminster was where it was, and it was 2 or 3 weeks, and it was wonderful. I don't think they do it anymore, but they had like 5 or 6 master teachers, and you would go and sign up for a week or two, you know, you audition, and then you would get in to work so many days with each of these teachers or, you know, whatever they were offering. And one of the weeks that I was there, wasn't expecting it. I was there to work with a famous vocal teacher. Who was your teacher, Wayne?
I had two in Boston.
Harshaw.
I had Margaret Harshaw in, I was actually it's dating myself. I was there the first year that Margaret Harshaw was there, too.
Wowie zowie.
My freshman year was Margaret Harshaw. So at Indiana, my teacher was Margaret Harshaw, and also Charles Kuhlman. I studied with him for the first year and with Margaret Harshaw for the last 3.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I know that I went to Westminster to work that week with Harshaw. She was, you know, working with singers, and was really cool because you got to do these big programs at the end, you know, at the end of the week, and it was a lot of fun. But anyway... for some reason, Goldovsky was in there, and I wasn't really looking forward to working with him, but I had signed up and was there, so I did that week. And I tell you what, I don't remember ever working with anyone except maybe Joan Dorneman, that so impacted my life within opera. So we started out, you know, he was a crusty, very dry, older guy. You know, he was near the end at this point. You know, he was late in his career and life. And he was really sort of there to share what he could. And I got the feeling that he didn't really care whether or not you took it. He was just going to do what he was going to do and whatever, you know. And I remember being there. I was probably in my mid-20s, late 20s, or maybe 25, 26. And being really shook by the fact that it became really clear really soon that this guy was brilliant. Like, I was just starting out. Unlike you, I didn't start opera till I was like 22. I started really late. I was a tap dancing music theater person. And I had worked in musical theater, you know, professionally the day I turned 18, when I got legal, when I was legal to start working in clubs and stuff. So, you know, but I met Joan Dorneman in Europe, and she was the one that said, you should be singing opera. And so that's how I sort of got started. And so around 25, 26, Boris Goldovsky, I was doing this thing, and he really steeped me in what this opera thing was supposed to be, things that I had never thought of before, dramatically speaking. And I remember people, the other students, like not getting, it seemed like they didn't really understand who this man was, like how great this man was. And I saw him one time in the cafeteria during one of the breaks, because these classes were all day. They were like 3 hours break, another 3 hours, you know. And I went and sat, I remember I took my tray and I sat at the table, and he was alone at the table. I mean, like,
oh my gosh,
seriously, Boris Goldovsky. And he had books beside him, and he had two books. And I sat down and I started talking to him, and we had a great time. And he kind of got more warm as we got to talk. You know, he became, it wasn't just so like, here's the information and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was telling him, you know, I just couldn't believe that people were not all sitting around to try to talk to him, you know, with everything. And his thing, what I think he really felt that at that point, opera was going to decline. I mean, I really think he felt that. He wasn't like overtly saying it, but again, very wry sense of humor. Well, for like two, I think he was there for 10 days. I don't know. I can't remember, but it was over a week. I got to have lunch and dinner with Boris Goldovsky. And what a world of education those 2 weeks was. Oh, my goodness.
I'll bet. Yeah, he was a fount of knowledge. There's no question about it.
And his books. His books are brilliant. Anybody that has any passing interest in the world of opera as a performer, you must read his books. And he brings the Stanislavski technique of acting, mm-hmm. which was a straight mm-hmm. acting technique, to the world of opera. And yeah. I think changed it. So did you get to work with Boris?
Oh, I did. I actually did his Rigoletto tour. I sang the Duke, and the funny thing, the other tenor, he double cast it because there were a lot of performances.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, you know, people get sick, and especially tenors, if they get sick, they don't sing. Yep. They can't sing.
Right.
So he did a tour, and at the ninth hour, the thing about Boris is he was very, like Sarah, he was fearless.
Yeah.
And he had his own translations of everything.
Yeah.
So you had to learn Boris's English translation of Rigoletto, not the Schirmer translation or any of the printed translations, which made it a little bit difficult because it was probably a translation you'd never use again if you did it in English. But it was interesting. And his acting, the Stanislavski stuff, he was able to adapt that to the music.
He did.
A great component of, you know, listen to the music, and the music will, in many cases, tell you how to react or how to act. And that worked very well, I think, in many cases, because opera is different than straight acting. It is different. You know, there's timing in opera that you don't have in straight acting.
Yeah, I mean, you could be dying or saying goodbye for 10 minutes. You know, how do you make that? How do you make that real? And that's what I think he fascinated me with that regard of, you know, because to me, from being musical theater, which is pretty much straight on, right in your face, it is what it is. And it really does go pretty much real time. Right, unless mm-hmm. you're talking like in Oklahoma, the dream sequence, the big dance dream sequence. The timing of what's in musical theater is just what's presented, whereas the timing in opera is not at all. You know, depending on what the composer wants to bring to the part, it stretches. It can stretch mm-hmm. for a great amount. And never knew it at that point, but at 20, in my mid-20s, that always kind of bothered me. I hadn't done a whole lot of performing. I had done mostly coaching, learning operas, learning the language with Joan, and had not gotten to the point yet where how do we make that viable on stage? It didn't seem real. That was the component that made it seem real. What he did was brilliant. You are so lucky to have worked with him, because although we were directed a little bit by him, it was only in an educational format. I can only imagine what that must have been like to, you know, to be with him. Did you find, because he did it in English translation, that's what you were, you know, for our listeners, you were saying that he would translate these pieces to English.
Correct.
Did you find that he the dramatic impulses that he felt the characters had was why those translations were different, were more difficult or challenging?
Well, I mean, translating something, opera especially, translating a foreign language into English in an opera situation, because, you know, you have to, there's a rhythm to the text.
Sure.
There's a rhythm to the words, and it has to sort of fit. There's a bunch of ways to come at that. You can come at it and say, well, if it rhymed in Italian, we'll make it rhyme in English.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the most dangerous way
totally,
to go. Because
totally.
you get some very strange
weird.
Things that happen, weird things that happen that don't really aren't really saying what the text is saying in the interest of making it rhyme.
Correct.
So I don't. He didn't go that way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go that. Then you also, as far as singers go, when you're dealing with high voices, especially sopranos and tenors, what vowel winds up on the high note is
matters.
Also very important. Yeah, if it's an A vowel in Italian and it becomes an E vowel in English, it's a very different. It's a very different sensation for the singing.
Yeah, yeah.
For the singer. So he was very careful about that, and he did watch that if the vowel was open, an A up on the high B flat or high C, he didn't put an E vowel on there.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember once singing a performance when I was very young of Carmen. Which I never should have been singing at that point, but I was fearless as a young singer, and I looked and said, oh, I have all the notes, so
yes.
I can sing that piece.
Yeah.
And I remember in the very last scene, there's a big part where the tenor, where just before he stabs her, and the translation was, for the in French, it was is a high A sharp.
Yeah.
And in French, it was Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
Because her name in French is not Carmen, it is Carmen.
Yeah.
So on this high A sharp, you had to sing, for the very last time, Carmen.
Yeah.
The English translation was, for the very last time, you fiend up
no.
there. Which was just,
oh,
I said,
horrible.
And I said, you know, this is impossible. I can't do you, I can't do you fiend up there on that,
I'm gonna,
on that high note.
Holy moly. All
right. I'm going back to Carmen.
Yeah. I don't blame you. All right, we have a little break here. We're going to take a break. Come right back with Wayne Revere, WKXL New Hampshire Talk Radio. Stay with us. We're coming right back. Hello there. If you are just joining us, this is Jane Cormier and Artful Living here on WKXL, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com, WKXL 1450 AM, 103.9 FM Concord, and 101.9 FM in Manchester. And if you're with us, just joining us, we're talking about opera. We're talking about the wonderful world that lies within the world of opera and our friend Wayne Revere, who has been on the show many times, great opera performer, teacher, tells great stories. I love having him here. It's a real pleasure. So, Wayne, in the last segment, you were talking about Carmen, and you were talking
yes.
about how sometimes when we translate opera, especially for singers that have high notes, you have to be careful what words you give them in the translation to make that palatable, you know, for the singer that has to do that high note. And you were talking about at the end of Carmen, the tenor, where he, you know, he stabs Carmen. And in the English translation, you were supposed to sing "You fiend," which a big E vowel on the high B flat, right?
Ooh, an E, yeah, A sharp. You fiend.
And that was Goldovsky who did that.
No.
Oh,
no,
right.
this was, believe it or not, this is when I was still in the conservatory as a student.
Okay.
This was at the Harvard Opera.
Okay.
You know, Harvard used to do an opera every year, and they did it in English. And, of course, they used the Harvard kids to conduct and prepare it. And
was this Lowell House? Was it Lowell House?
Yes, it was.
Do you know, I did my first flute at Lowell House.
Really? Yeah. Lowell House, right.
Isn't that funny?
Isn't that funny? Yeah, they had good performances there. They had the orchestra was excellent, and they had some very talented Harvard kids. But a lot of them were green, and you know, somebody did a translation of this, and because they said, I talked to the guy that did the translation. I said, "Look, this is a problem here," and talking about Carmen, that we call her Carmen. But in French, she is called Carmen.
Yeah.
And Bizet was French, so the accent is on the final syllable, Carmen.
Yeah.
In French, the accent is usually on the last syllable. So he said, "Well, because we're translating this into English, you know, it doesn't really fit to sing Carmen because we say Carmen." Mm-hmm. So that's why I translated it to Euphine. And I said, "Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go back to Carmen because I can't sing those vowels up there."
What did he say?
He agreed. He went away. He was cooperative.
Good.
He was cooperative.
Don't upset
the tenor, he said, you know. That's fine.
Good practice.
But Boris understood that very well. He understood singers and what they needed, and he didn't usually put difficult vowels in his translation.
Yeah, no. He was pretty brilliant. What year did he die? Do you know?
I don't know. You know, I don't know when he died.
I think he passed not long after that class. And I remember thinking, I'm so glad. You want to know he died in 2001. Born in Moscow, Russia in 1908, and he died in February 2001. And I had two books, one of which he wrote me a pretty wonderful paragraph in the front of the book. And when I was a teacher, I had quite a nice little library, especially with singers. You know, if Joan, for instance, you know, I got to meet some really big singers when I was working with her, famous singers. And it was nice to have them write, you know, a little note on the books. And of course, I never valued it as much as I should have. And when I became a teacher, you know, when I got older, I would lend my books out. Right? You know, I would think, "Oh, this is great. You know, go ahead, just take it and make sure I get it back." And I can't tell you the number of books I've lost over the years.
Oh, I'm sure.
And
I'm sure
one of Boris's books is the one I lost. How I'm crushed that I don't remember at all who I gave it to. But he was quite a guy and brilliant, just so brilliant.
Yes, he was. And he was born in Moscow. He had a very heavy accent, which we were convinced there was part of his persona.
Yeah.
His public persona. And somebody said, "Yeah, Boris's accent seems to get thicker every year."
That's all right. It works for me.
Yeah.
I think you're right. It was part of his persona. And you know what? He was a wonderful musician. A really fun piano player. And people don't realize that. He really had it all. But boy, did he understand the musical component, the drama component of the music. That's what I thought was so great. He could pick it right out. And he and actually Hal Prince, I got to work with Hal Prince at Phantom when I was in Europe. And Prince, I don't know if he knew about Goldovsky or stole some of his stuff. But I remember that really the practice of active listening on stage was really important to Prince. But it was even more important when Goldovsky, you know, was teaching, in that you can't just wait until the other singer is going to say what they're going to say. You have to help set up the other singer by listening and reacting to what they're saying. And I remember Goldovsky saying, "And you have to do it, even if it's a foreign language." And his thing was, if they can't understand the language, your job is through your acting to make sure they can understand what's happening.
And through the music, yes.
That's right. He was very much the actor through the music. He wasn't the actor, let's do these motions. And no, everything was dependent on what he heard in the music prior to the drama, prior to the event.
Right.
Just brilliant stuff, you know. I don't know.
Well, he was a trailblazer at his time. You know, people have picked up that. And I think Sarah actually, well,
yes.
People steal from each other. That's what we do.
Yes.
That's in some ways the way you learn. I try to usually give people credit for something, but we take things from people and we use them and we incorporate them. But I think that Sarah, because she worked with Boris at Tanglewood for, you know, when she was up there in Tanglewood as a violist in the orchestra, she worked with him very closely, and I think she stole a lot of stuff from him.
And
too.
Why shouldn't she, right? I mean, this stuff isn't meant to be kept, and, you know,
you've
got to share it, you know?
Right.
Do you see anybody today out there, Wayne, on the level of putting it all out there for the medium, like Goldovsky and Caldwell did?
Well, I've been out of the mainstream of the opera performance theater for a long time now, but no, I actually don't. And I think conductors, or certainly stage directors, sometimes have a different view of everything. It's become very visual, a lot of it. And
right.
A lot of the visual means that they've taken some of the visual stuff away. I mean, I saw a performance of Eugene Onegin where the set was really just six high back chairs on the stage and a black background.
Yeah.
So that wasn't much of a set. And I don't understand sometimes why directors feel that they have to have some unique or unknown concept to these pieces done. I mean, these pieces to me were done at a certain point in time, at a certain social, you know, when people had different social feelings about things.
Sure.
And costumes and things like that should in many ways reflect what the composer had in mind. I mean, it's okay to try to make them today, bring them so that everybody can understand them, but sometimes it doesn't work.
Right.
Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And one of the things about people like Goldovsky, and even Sarah to a great extent too, is that they tried to preserve the historic value of the piece. For instance, doing a Mozart opera like The Marriage of Figaro, I'm not going to name any names, but doing and staging it, you know, in the sewers of New York or in the Trump Tower.
Stupid.
I think I did see a production where they put The Marriage of Figaro staged in the Trump Tower.
Mm.
And then they put it in modern dress. And one person said to me one time, well, that means they have no costume budget.
Well, that's not far-flung, and that's sometimes why we see minimalist opera, I think, today. And they like to pretend that it's some high-flying, you know, dramatic concept, when many, many times I think it's just because they feel like, who's going to care? We'll just have it sung. You know, we'll just sing it, and we'll just have a good orchestra, and that's it. But that's not what it was supposed to be.
Well, if you're looking at the visual aspect, I mean, when I hear a Mozart opera, I hear satin and powdered wigs and all of that elegance that people had and the movement that they had back at that time. I don't hear something that's modern and contemporary, that the horror takes place on the streets of New York.
It just,
for me, that doesn't work. But for some people, I guess maybe it's making it more accessible to them.
Maybe.
Different strokes for different folks. Boris was pretty traditional.
Yes, he was. He was. He was very much into what the whole thing was all about. Wayne Rivera, thank you so much for joining us on WKXL Artful Living. It's always a delight to speak with you. And
Jane, you as well. And just a quick thing here. I just have to say, I've done quite a bit of work for you over the years.
Yes.
This new Opera Idol contest here, I'm very, very impressed with the singers that you consider auditioning for this. It's a really, really very good group. It's going to be very hard to find to choose winners in this group.
Well, that's good for the people. Come on out and you can cheer for your winner.
Oh, absolutely. And the repertoire is very interesting too.
Good.
Very interesting repertoire.
Awesome. All right, Wayne, we'll call it here, and thanks again for checking in with us, and hopefully we'll have you on again in the future and talk some more opera. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Jane.
Take care now, and thank you for joining us. WKXL, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com, Artful Living here. We'll see you next time, and thanks for being with us.